Okay, good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Transportation Committee to order. Today is Monday, November 20th, 2023. We're in the Denali Room at the Anchorage LIO. Let the record reflect that the time is 1:03. Today we have Representative Tom McKay, Representative Sarah Vance's staffer, Representative Sumner, Representative Stutes via teleconference, Representative Mina, and myself, Chair McCabe. Staff assisting us today are Recording Secretary Jordan Wright and Moderator Johan Timmers. Thank you both for your service. And there is Representative Vance in person. And also like to thank my committee aides and welcome Representative Johnson. I'd like to thank my committee aides, Julie Morris and Angela Steffel, for their work in putting this together. I know it's a little unusual, but we wanted to have this somewhere where folks could actually get to us instead of in Juneau. And we could do this during session, but I thought it might be more fun here where people come and visit and see. We have three items of business today. The committee will hear a presentation from the Mat-Su Bureau on Port McKenzie. We'll hear from the Alaska Railroad Corporation, and then we'll take public testimony on any of the issues or that we discussed today. My hope is this meeting will provide a comprehensive update on the ongoing developments at Port McKenzie and the Port Mac Rail Extension, otherwise known as PMRE. You may hear that today a bit. Within the railroad sector, our goal is to engage in a thorough discussion about their mission, vision, and future plans for rail development. They also have some updated cost figures for us on both the Northern Rail Extension and PMRE. We will discuss federal funding and explore strategies aimed at optimizing the efficiency of freight and resource, especially resource transportation in Alaska. We have representatives of the Federal Rail Administration and the DOT listening, and we will forward any questions to them for written responses. In addition, we may have on the phone, we have members of Senator Sullivan and Murkowski's offices that I'd like to welcome them to listening in at this time. Okay, so right now I'd like to ask Borough Representatives Mike Brown. Nick's not here?
He will not.
Okay, and Port Operations Manager Dave Griffin, they're already at the table for their presentation. I'd like to thank the Mat-Su Bureau for all the work you've been doing at the port. I toured it, I think, a month ago or so, and was very, very impressed at the maintenance and the upkeep of the port, even though there hasn't been much going on. Dave is working to try to get more of that going. And I think there's exciting things on the horizon for the port. Just need to work together to see the project through. So, Mike and Dave, if you'd place your names on the record and in your presentation whenever you're ready.
Okay, we're good. Good afternoon, and thank you. I'm Mike Brown. I'm the Mat-Su Bureau Manager. With me.
Good afternoon. My name is David Griffin. I'm the Port Operations Manager.
Thanks, and I'd like to also welcome Representative Tilton, Speaker Tilton, who is on the phone.
Very good. Thank you. All right. We'll get started. We're going to give you, Representative McCabe mentioned, a little bit of an overview of Port McKenzie, talk about some of the things we're doing with regards to infrastructure and business development, and we'll talk a little bit about PMRE. So now that you've introduced that acronym, we'll just start running with that. I thought I would begin with a short 4-minute video just to kind of give you some overview. It's very visual, so it'll help you kind of give you some perspective for what Port McKenzie entails, and then I'll dive into it from there.
Port McKenzie, the only port in Alaska that offers 9,000 acres of open space, all dedicated to commercial and industrial development. Port McKenzie has 60 feet of water at low tide, with no dredging required.
Deep draft dock out here at Port McKenzie is an amazing facility. We can accommodate ships up to 1,200 feet long. We have plenty of water, even at mean low water. We have 60-foot depth. We do not have to dredge, and there's plenty of workspace out on the trestle and platform for operating cranes, semi-trucks, forklifts, loaders, and any other sort of equipment that you may need to move freight and cargo. McKenzie is an industrial port. As of late, it's been used a lot for bringing in cement, which is used on different road projects throughout the state. And one of our tenants is Quality Asphalt and Paving. They bring a ship in a year with super sacks of cement, which is actually stored on site in some warehouse buildings. And then depending on where the projects and the needs are, that cement is then used on those projects. We also work really closely with some of the smaller construction companies that are moving goods and services to locations further south of here in the Upper Cook Inlet area. In fact, some of the barges will take cargo and equipment, fuel and freight, all the way down to the lower Kuskokwim and then use the Kuskokwim River corridor to move these barges. There's also cargo and freight that leave this port, they go all the way up the Yukon River. So considering that where Port McKenzie is located, we're helping meet the needs of not only regional operators in Upper Cook Inlet, but also helping contractors with projects that are in Western Alaska. Historically, this conveyor system was constructed to export wood chips, and the wood chips came off the top of the hill, came down, hit a conveyor, and then would come up this conveyor here that you see behind me. But what we did was we took a section of it and we brought it out here on the trestle, and so we're using it to offload the ship and then move the salt out onto the gravel pad. And this conveyor, it's been a while since it's been used, but it still runs really well, and we're excited that we were able to reconfigure it for this project.
We'll continue with the presentation now. Appreciate our public affairs folks putting that together in conjunction with Dave Griffin. So I'm gonna jump ahead here a couple slides, and I want to begin with kind of a regional overview. And obviously, folks that are in South Central, this may not be news, but I didn't want to take it for granted. So what we have up here is a map of current proposed access for Port McKenzie. So I'm going to follow the blue circles in numbers. So obviously, is what you see in number one is the core area of the Matsu Borough, or the valley, and in that Palmer Wasilla core area. And you'll see where we're going to go with this. As you move down to number two, you see as you follow South Kinnick Goose Bay Road down to Point McKenzie Road down to the port, what we call a port district, where Port McKenzie is located. So the red boundary, red shaded area is what we call the port district. So it's the lands that are associated with Port McKenzie and are zoned commercial industrial. Point number three is the proposed Port McKenzie Rail Extension, or PMRE, which is under construction. So you can see that 32-mile segment. We'll dive into the specifics of that here in a moment. If you go just to the west of that, to point number four, you see the proposed West Susitna Access Road. As you will notice, PMRE and the West Susitna Access Road, there's kind of a natural confluence there at West Ayrshire Avenue. So that you see those projects where they come together, which is just west of where Point McKenzie Road doglegs down to Port McKenzie. So you see this, some of the different transportation infrastructure that kind of come together in this area. And then And then, of course, when you look down to point number five, that's where the proposed Kubota or Kinnick Arm Bridge right-of-way is platted. So you can kind of see there's some of this coming together of some of the transportation infrastructure in this area, and that kind of gives you a regional overview of Port McKenzie, the port district, and how the PMRE connects into that and connects to the main line in Houston, just off of the Parks Highway. As far as Port McKenzie highlights, I put the port link there as well. All of this information and a lot more are on a website. I'm just going to hit a few of the highlights this afternoon. As Dave mentioned in the video, our deep draft dock has a 1,200-foot face, so you can get some very large ships in there. And, of course, with a depth of 60 feet there, you can accommodate those deep draft vessels. And so he talked about in that video, concrete happens annually. Done a salt ship here recently, and there's been other project-based cargo like concrete-coated pipe and other projects that come from time to time. As far as the barge dock, that dock area down there adjacent to along with the deep draft dock, it's about 15 acres of gravel surface barge dock down there. So it does, that comes also with the 372-foot bulkhead for barge docking, and that's a 20-foot deep, or 20-foot mean low level low water. And then you have the land associated with it. That was that red box I talked about on the previous slide. The port district itself contains about 9,000 acres of uplands that is available for commercial and industrial development. And then all of the lands in the port district are publicly owned. The majority of those are borough, but there is some university land that's within that port district as well. And then equipment and services, I put a list there, but there is a 7,000-foot square foot terminal building available for Class A office space and whatnot. You can probably imagine what that was originally conceived and constructed for, but that serves as a nice space where folks, if they're basing an operation out of Port McKenzie project or otherwise, may want to have access to those types of facilities.
So before you move on, Mr. Brown, maybe there's questions, and I'd also like to recognize that Representative Kalum joined us on the phone at 1:10, and I forgot to mention that the Representative Brown came in all the way in from his trap line to be with us today. So. I have a question if nobody else does. You mentioned equipment and services, so I'm interested to know about the MARAD grant and the crane.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about that here in just a minute, if that's okay.
Perfect.
All right, yeah, not to put you off.
No worries.
Just, yeah, we'll build
Mr.
that in,
Chair?
And I kind of want to talk about what else is going on as
I'm
well.
I'm sorry, Representative Stutz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did I hear you say that all this land is either owned by the borough or publicly owned? So my question would be, you wouldn't require purchasing any land from private owners?
Yes, through the chair, the Representative Stutz, that's correct. All of the land within the Port District, the 9,000 acres I'm referring to, is publicly owned. It's not all necessarily held by the borough. There's some state components with, like, the university, for example. There are some private properties around that area, but they're very small, and we do work with them to make sure that they retain access to those properties.
Perfect. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else?
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've just put a couple of photos in here, because if you haven't been down to Port McKenzie, sometimes it's difficult to envision it. So this is looking south across Port McKenzie. So you see the dock, the terminal building, the trestle, the deep draft dock looking towards Anchorage. So you can literally see how close it is, and then actually you're looking right at the port of Anchorage as well. So you can see how close those two are. Moving on, looking northwest from Anchorage across Port McKenzie to the West Susitna area. And I'll talk about this in a minute because I did bring a couple of maps, and those are available to each of the committee members in your folder. Just to show you kind of beyond the 9,000 acres that I just spoke to, what lands, predominantly state lands, are available beyond that. So in the background, you can see transmission lines. There's a gas line out in this area, and then obviously looking out towards Mount Susitna. So again, the key features of Port McKenzie, and we've kind of hit on these already, but I wanted to help kind of visualize that quickly. So you see from the top moving down the leasable uplands, the 9,000 acres we just spoke of, the nearly 15 acres along the dock, 7,000 square foot terminal building. In the video, you saw the bow ramp. There was actually a barge pulled up to that. That doesn't have a long loiter time, but we often see construction companies using that for project cargo for Western Alaska. So they'll pull that up, rolling stock, loaders, connexes, et cetera. They'll roll that on, roll it off, and move that project cargo west. The barge dock, the 372-foot face, you see the deep draft dock at 1,200 feet, 470-foot trestle, and in the video it highlighted there's a lot of space to maneuver on that. Part of that point of that video was to show that we had those two tractor trailers running simultaneously to move those super sacks of concrete from the vessel to the uplands to those warehouses. So there is a fair amount of space down there that to maneuver. And then finally, the access that goes up the hill to the what we call the uplands, that is paved access. So that'll give you kind of all of those key features overview. And then I mentioned already the water levels at both the barge dock and the deep draft dock.
So maybe you're going to get to this one as well, but you want to talk a little bit about the plans for the barge bow ramp. So right now, I think you said when I was there, there was like a 4-hour loiter time. And so.
Absolutely. I've got a slide for that here.
Perfect. Okay. You and I are.
That way you can actually see it.
I should just shut up and let you.
Oh, no. I appreciate the questions, actually.
Turn off his mic. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when the guy was giving the presentation on the port, the conveyor belt was initially built for wood chips. Can you just go into that just a little bit?
Yeah, so if you look here on this graphic, you can see the conveyor starting out here on the trestle. You can track it back. Right here, this was its previous configuration prior to the summer. Then you can see it coming across the dock, up the hill to the uplands, and then there was a pad up here where the wood chips would be stored, and they would be conveyed in this direction as an export. So, interestingly, we had a contractor who had a contract to bring in salt, wanted to find a more efficient way to offload it. Obviously, the conveyor, as I just described to you, is heading outbound, not inbound. So what they did is pulled this conveyor from right in this area here, reconfigured it, and put it here along the trestle to offload the salt, bring it in, and store it on the on the dock.
Okay, thank you. So somebody had an idea to export wood chips. Am I correct?
That's correct.
And where would those have come from?
There's a lot of timber, whether it's state lands, borough lands, out in the borough. I think they had originally conceived, and this is where it'll see Dave's in my history a little bit, but they had timber contracts to basically bring that down, chip it, and export it. And that was many years ago. I've heard a couple of different variations as to why that wasn't successful, but I think one of the more challenging issues with timber these days is the quality of it due to the spruce bark beetle infestation.
Thank you. I just appreciate somebody had an idea about actually using our forest. I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Representative Sumner has a question.
Yeah, through the chair, when I was up there, that uplands area, the other end of the conveyor belt, like it had coal there. Had you guys used the conveyor belt for loading coal at some point?
Through the chair, they did. They did do a coal test shipment, but it was just a test shipment. So they did use the conveyor. There would be some challenges with using the current conveyor to convey coal onto a ship, just by its nature and design. But they did do a test shipment using the conveyor at one time.
So I think that was the that test was the biggest ship in the world at the time, if I'm not mistaken, right? Brought it in here with no problems and loaded a bunch of coal on it. That one. Yep.
I think it's that. Yeah, it's the JP Azure, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's actually what the picture it's of. That ship there, it's off.
Anyone else?
You will continue. Well, there you go. There's your test coal shipment. So there's your picture of it up close. As you can see, it is a very large ship. And then these highlight a couple of the other features of the concrete super sacks unloading on the trestle, where QAP was moving that. And then you see here a barge, a docked at the barge dock itself. We also, as I mentioned, the barging containers and equipment using the bow ramp. That's the four-hour loiter time that Representative Cabe mentioned. But you can see that they've got containers and rolling stock that you can roll on and off to move project park. And then here's the future work. This is what Representative McCabe was alluding to. So I wanted to highlight these three items specifically. So this is just another overhead shot of the dock area itself. And as Representative McCabe mentioned, there's a couple of federal grants in play here. The first one is a deep draft dock pile sleeves. So for the deep draft dock out here, basically wrapping these piles to protect them from corrosion and extending the useful life of the deep draft dock. So that's a U.S. Economic Development Administration grant that the borough received a couple of years ago. That project is actually moving forward, and we hope to have contract award probably within the next couple of months. So that should put that project out to construction at some point starting in 2024, 2025. The second item is an addition of a 300 by 200 foot barge ramp. So that's what's depicted up here to the top of the slide. This is what Representative McCabe was speaking to as adding a new capability to Port McKenzie. So our borough assembly set some funding aside for that here within the last 2 months. And that project is currently being designed. So the idea there is to create, if you will, a large, if you were trying to envision it, really just like a large boat launch. But what it would allow is for barges to come in. It would actually allow us with airbags to take those barges out of the water, bring them up to the dock area, and perform maintenance. That is currently something we can't do. It also would allow for improved roll-on, roll-off capabilities. When we talked about the barge landing, as Representative McCabe noted, it has a short loiter window. This would improve that and allow for barges to come up, drop their ramps, and have an extended stay for putting cargo on or off of those vessels. So it really creates some new opportunities that we currently do not have at Port McKenzie. So we're hoping to advance that design here over the next several months, garner full funding, and then move that project forward for construction. So that's one we think would be very helpful to Port McKenzie in terms of expanding its current capabilities. And then the third item, Representative McCabe also hit on this already, so you can tell he's been out there and spent some time around Port McKenzie, is we are looking to purchase a 75-ton mobile harbor crane. That was a recent award of roughly $1 million from the U.S. Marine Highway Program. So that's a MARAD program, as the representative mentioned. We're very pleased to see that move forward. So that will add also some capabilities to Port McKenzie in terms of material handling. Because as when you look at the bulkhead or the barge dock, as I previously referred to it, it's difficult there because we don't currently have a crane at Port McKenzie that would allow for easier onload offload. Somebody would have to mobilize that piece of equipment, which has been done at times, but having a crane there would be very helpful for anyone that would want to bring a barge in and do that type of thing. So those are some of the three key items for changes and future work coming for McKenzie. I'll pause to see if there are any questions.
Sure. Well, I'm almost certain Representative Stutz has a question. You said Marine Highway. How does that play into Port McKenzie?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, years ago, a member of borough staff at that time actually submitted to MARAD to add Port McKenzie to the U.S. Marine Highway System. So we actually, believe it or not, I found this out after I took the job and was quite surprised that the borough is actually a sponsor of that route, that smaller route that connects Port McKenzie to the Marine Highway System. So once we became aware of that, we thought, well, there's this great program out there. They typically are smaller grants. I think they had roughly $10 million in available funding nationwide. And so for us to pick up $1 million of that or a tenth of it, I think is helpful, because there are smaller projects that you can pursue with that program that maybe don't fit exactly under the PIDP program, which is also a MARAD program. We also did apply for Port Infrastructure Development Program, or PIDP grant, as well. We did not win that. There are a lot of communities across Alaska that do that on an annual basis. So we thought we would also use that grant application and that opportunity for PIDP to take a shot at the U.S. Marine Highway grant. We were successful. So obviously you're not going to do, you know,
a $20 million project under that program, but it does provide opportunities for smaller firms.
Thanks. So if we ever wanted the Tusty to come into the Mat-Su Bureau, that would be possible? Sorry, Representative Stutes, I'm watching
Don't
your face.
Be sorry. Keep it at the top of the...
All right.
So now let's transition a little bit, talk about Port McKenzie Rail Extension. I know the Alaska Railroad Corporation will have a more detailed presentation to follow, so I just hit some really high project highlights here. So we use this construction status map. That 11 by 17 is available in your packets. We brought that as a separate PDF so you can get the full scale and have that as a reference. It's a great tool for just helping to envision the different segments, because we start talking about those and people are like, I don't understand. So this really makes it a little bit easier to visualize. And like I said, that 11 by 17 is available as well. In a nutshell, this is a 32-mile rail extension from Port Mac to the main line in Houston. And I'm sure I saw some of the railroad slides, so I know they're going to detail some of the project accounting with $184 million invested by the state of Alaska in the project to date. Obviously, we need funding required to fully construct, and I will defer to the Alaska Railroad Corporation for that cost estimate. They have engaged with a third-party estimator to update that here very recently. So I'll leave them to speak to that. We do have embankment for segments 1, 3, 4, and 5 constructed. Segment 2 is not. The way that works is segment 1 starts at Port McKenzie, works its way up to segment 6, which connects to the rail line. And you can see the length of each of those segments in the graphic that's attached. All the segments except segment 6 require tracks, ties, and ballast. Again, I'll defer to the railroad. They're the rail experts here in the room today. I do want to mention at the top right of the slide that web link is a great interactive story map that includes a virtual tour and pictures of that rail alignment. So we have an amazing GIS team that put that story map together, and that's publicly available. So folks can go in there. You can go through the different segments. You can see, you can interact with the mapping layers, and it'll show you the land ownership that's adjacent to the rail corridor. It'll also give you pictures of the bridges and the crossings and all the different things that our staff took this past summer. So we wanted to do that to try to provide a better way to tell this story and allow folks to interact and see what that potential and opportunity looks like without having to physically visit the corridor itself. So I would encourage anyone to take a look at that. Of course, the challenges, PMRE, and this is where, you know, you'll see a little bit of frustration, but PMRE began in 2006 with an EIS in 2011. Funding stalled in 2015, and all funding to date has been state legislative grants. So really, the project's been idle for a number of years now, and it's something that we're very focused on working towards completion. As I mentioned, it was state legislative grants, so if we do want to dabble into some federal funding, we would have to quote-unquote federalize the project, which basically means going back, updating the environmental permitting process, having a discussion around a non-federal match, and getting a detailed benefit cost analysis. As again, the railroad will be speaking to this in more detail, but I wanted to give you kind of the borough overview of how we see the project. I don't think it'll differ much from what you'll hear from the Alaska Railroad.
So phase two, the rights-of-way were the reason it didn't do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So phase two was waiting on rights-of-way, but I understand those are all complete. So
we do have, that's correct, to the chair. We have all the right-of-way acquired for this project. Now, there is a slight, there were some conditions in a couple of the right-of-way, or the easements acquired with one of the native corporations that had some provisions that if the rail wasn't operational within 10 years, that those would have to be renegotiated or revert. So that is something in 2025 that we'll be having to address because of the stalled nature of this project due to no additional funding. So we have already engaged with that corporation, and we're talking about what that might look like. But yes, there, outside of that, we have the right-of-way acquired for this project and the permits in.
Thanks, and I think Representative Stutes has a question.
I do. Thank you very much. So, and you're here representing the Mat-Su Bureau, am I correct?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Thank you. So, through the chair, would the borough be responsible for keeping, if there were a railroad situation placed there, would the borough be responsible for keeping that railway open, particularly in the winter months? Who would be maintaining it? Or is it the anticipation that the railroad would have to maintain it and keep it open?
And so through the chair, the intent, and there have been discussions around transferring the right-of-way once the project's completed and it's and it goes operational as a railroad, that then the railroad would be transferred to the Alaska Railroad Corporation. The borough retained it at the time. The decision previous to mine, I'm glad we did, because it does allow us to have conversations about multi-use corridor. So those conversations were starting, but then the funding stalled, so those conversations kind of took a back burner because there was no additional construction happening on the embankment or moving us any closer to actually having an operational.
Thank you. And can I have a follow-up, please, Mr.
Certainly.
Chair? Thank you. So, and do I, does it, it appears to me from looking at your maps that the railway only currently, if this were put in place, only goes as far as Houston. Is that correct?
Yes, so that's where, in Houston is where it connects to the main line along the Parks Highway. So, and it's very difficult to see there, but in segment six, we call it the Y. It's actually physically connected. There's siding along there as well that the railroad can use to pull cars off of the main line. So that segment six is actually the one segment that's completely constructed and operational today. So the Alaska Railroad uses that today. They can speak to how that may be beneficial operationally, but segment six is actually fully constructed.
Okay, and then if from that point with segment six, if I might, Mr. Chair.
Of course.
Then the railway goes all the way up to Fairbanks?
Through the chair, that's correct, and all the way south to Anchorage. That is actually the rail main line. The rail main line.
So the anticipation then would be you could move all kinds of cargo and supplies and whatever came into the port. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is absolutely correct.
Oh, wow. See, I learn something new all the time. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Next slide.
So I'm going to introduce another part of this equation, because obviously when we talk about a port, it's pretty clear that we're talking about access to tide. So now I want to talk about access to land. And so this is that a drill in of that red box I showed you on the regional overview earlier. And I know that when we convert these to PDF, it kind of washes out the colors a little bit. So this map is also available all the committee members as a separate PDF, so you can have a much better view of this. So this is just an inset into this presentation. Obviously, it's color-coded, yellow, blue, gray, and I know some of that washes out in the presentation itself. But essentially, what you want to take away from that is within that red boundary, which is the port district, that 9,000 acres that I spoke of earlier. Again, it's predominantly borough-owned. There's some university land, and then the gray, you can see in a real copy, it's hard to kind of discern that here, those few parcels that I spoke of earlier. But what it shows you is kind of a drill in so you can see where the proposed right-of-way for Kinnickarn Crossing might be, where the Point McKenzie Rail Extension runs in, and then you'll see in there where that rail loop is, and we'll see that a little bit later. I'm sure the railroad will probably talk about that as well. But you can kind of see how all of that is overlaid as it traverses through the port district. And again, this port district is already zoned industrial commercial, so the permitting requirements to do work in this district are a little bit different than what it might be in other areas of the borough.
Next slide.
All right, so this one completely washed out on colors. I also brought this as a separate map, but I'll tell you what the story is right now. Basically, all of that area within the West Susitna area is shaded green. So you see the port district to the bottom right. That's that 9,000 acres we just talked about. As you move west, you will see where the gas line and the transmission lines for power traverse. And in that box, and not specifically, but in that whole area, this West Susitna area, there's approximately 700,000 acres with approximately 90% of it publicly owned. And when I say publicly owned, I mean predominantly the state of Alaska. So when you look at Port McKenzie, Port District, and the West Usitna area, this is the one port in the Upper Cook Inlet, I would argue, has access to both land and tidewater access. And you can see what that potential could look like for the state, not just the region, but the state of Alaska. So, again, those maps are available. I apologize that it washed out a little bit when we did the conversion to the PDF today, but that's really the takeaway. There is a small area in there, actually right here along the West Usitna Access Road, so that's what this dotted line is the proposed West Usitna Access Road, and this is that Ayrshire area we talked about. You see kind of the coming together of Point McKenzie Road, as well as the West Usitna Access Road. So there's this yellow block right in here. That's borough-owned, the rest of the state. So a ton of opportunity. And then again, so when I come back, I'm kind of wrapping up here with this regional overview, so I'm going to go back to where we started. And I think what you see here when you talk about Port McKenzie, you talk about the West Usitna, you talk about the land, the tidewater access, you also have access to a community. And so when we talk to folks about business development, we also talk to them about community support. You have a community out there in the borough that's very pro-development. They want to see economic activity. They want to see growth and development. Obviously, you know, we've been in a growing region for a number of years. It does provide you proximity to a workforce, proximity to housing, and proximity to other infrastructure. So when we talk about education, emergency services, roads, other transportation infrastructure, service industry, all of those things that a business would need to be successful, we have that in close proximity. And I would argue that Point McKenzie is really at a crossroads of a number of potential transportation improvements. So when you look at this area and you just kind of zoom out, try to understand the potential and the opportunity here, I think it goes far beyond just what Port McKenzie offers in terms of port itself. It's the adjacent lands. It's the fact that it's set up industrial. It's set up for commercial. And you have all of these lands. So as we talk to folks, and recently we've been talking, you know, a lot of folks that come and talk to us about potential business opportunities, really, lately, it's been more about energy than anything else. And so when they talk about these energy opportunities, they're looking for green energy, looking for something that has a connection to renewables, and something that you can then create that can be exported. And so when you look at that export opportunity, you need two things: access to tidewater, access to land. Because most of these renewable opportunities include wind, solar, or something like that that require land. And fair amount of land, not just a couple of acres. So as we see these folks come in and we have these conversations, and it's kind of interesting, there's an overlook in the uplands just above that pad that Representative Sumner was talking about where they took coal and shipped it out. There's this beautiful overlook, and you can look over and see Anchorage. You can look over and see Ted Stevens Airport. You can look over and see Fire Island. You look out over the West Usitna, and you see transmission lines. You know, there's a gas line there, and just all of this land. And then you look down the hill, and there's this port that's set up for industrial commercial purposes. So there's a lot of opportunity there. We'll see if any of these projects take shape. We've seen a lot more discussion around energy projects lately, I think, because of grants, federal grants and tax credits, and not just from this country. I think there are other countries that are interested in opportunities as well. So we continue to entertain those and try to put Port McKenzie on display. And as Representative McCabe mentioned earlier, you know, also put some investments into maintaining our existing infrastructure while at the same time creating new capabilities that align with the Upper Cook Inlet market. So I think that takes us to questions, if there are additional questions.
Thanks, Representative Stutz.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm full of questions. This is really interesting to me. So let me ask you this, not to pit one area against the other area, but what is the advantage of Port McKenzie over the Port of Anchorage?
A great question through the chair. I'm very interested in this too, just for the record. I think, you know, when I look at Anchorage, I don't look at that as like competition with Port McKenzie. What we're trying to do here is completely different than that. I think there are some opportunities to discuss like the use of Port McKenzie in the context of creating resiliency. Like, you know, a single point of failure is not great in any system. So I think there are some opportunities, but we're not trying to be the port of Anchorage. We are looking at this from an industrial commercial component, and we are looking at it because I think what sets us apart from Anchorage or any other port in the Upper Cook Inlet is not just the port itself, it's that access to land. And I think that's something that most other ports, specifically in this region, do not enjoy. They don't have access to those lands like we do.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair McCabe. Thank you for the presentation. Through the chair, I have two questions. The first is related to that EIS that was mentioned for the PMRE. Are there any takeaways from that EIS that were integrated in the current project plan for the PMRE?
Yes, so through the chair, when they did, and again, I'm going to speak on what I understand. I want to be very clear. I wasn't here during when the EIS was completed, but there were mitigation done for the wetlands. Beyond just the wetland mitigation, there was also a lot of consideration given to recreational and trail users in the area, the Iditarod Trail as an example. So there were a lot of trail crossings created, separated grade crossings, to allow for those recreational users and historic use to be retained. So they did look at that, went through that process, cultural resources, wetland delineation and determination, mitigation. So whenever there were wetlands that may have been disturbed, there were offsets through credits that were procured as part of the project to make sure that we met all of our federal permit requirements.
Thank you. I have a second question. Thank you. Through the chair, going back to the prospects for funding and looking at federalizing the project, how does the borough feel about going through that process, and could you go into more details of what that looks like?
Yeah, through the chair, I guess I'll just be very blunt. What I think the borough wants to see is this project completed. It's very frustrating to see $184 million investment from the state unrealized. There is really no public benefit for what's been constructed at this point. Yet, we're not that far away. A lot of those hurdles with design, permitting, the approvals that are required, even just to get construction going, the right-of-way being acquired is absolutely huge. I mean, that's a tough thing to do these days, especially for a new corridor. And if you consider a 32-mile corridor, that's a very large corridor. And when I think about some of the road projects that we do, very rarely do we ever talk about something more than a couple miles in terms of a new corridor that we would be creating in our new connection. So to have this idea that we create a 32-mile corridor, particularly if it's multi-use, would just be an amazing opportunity that would create access. So I think the borough's not opposed to going down the federal route. We just want to make sure everyone's clear on what has to be done or what would be different to get it done. But I think what we want to really see is complete projects. I think that's super important. I think voters, our taxpayers, really want to see things get finished that get started.
Thank you.
Thanks. Anyone else? So, Mr. Brown, maybe you want to talk a little bit about, you and I had a discussion about the utility corridor and the gas sort of thought. You mentioned something to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're trying to do it. It's up to you.
Yeah. Chair, so, one of the other things, and Representative Sumner remembers from his days on the Mattsu Borough Assembly, one of the things we are interested in is, and what we have been looking at, is how do you get lower cost energy to some of our communities that head up towards the Northern Valley? Mm-hmm. So right now, natural gas stops roughly in the Houston area, not in Houston proper. And when we had discussions with NSTAR about how would you potentially extend that natural gas opportunity to, say, Willow, for example, or up the Parks Highway, we found out that they can't. They don't have the capacity in the transmission line to go farther. It would actually have to create a new transmission line. So, for example, when we went to NSTAR, we said, hey, what would that look like and what would it take to extend that gas north? They came back and said, well, we would need to create that new transmission line. And what they did is they actually utilized the Port McKenzie Rail Extension Corridor That's where they would want to put the new gas line if they were to do that. It's more cost-effective and efficient to put the gas line there if you were to extend those services to the northern communities in the Mat-Su. So I think that's a good illustration of how this corridor might be multi-use, might be a utility corridor, whether it's, you know, could be, we've had companies contact us about putting fiber in that corridor as well, and power. So all of the utilities are interested in use of that corridor as well. Currently, nothing's been permitted in that corridor in terms of utilities at this time.
Thank you. I know that a lot of the new theory on corridors such as this, because they are so expensive and so prohibitive for just, you know, any government to do, is to combine them. So hence the multimodal utility corridor, including rail, possible road, possible gas line, all of that. That's I just got back from a PENWAR Pacific Northwest Economic Region discussion with some of the folks in Canada. That's exactly what they're doing. These are not rail corridors anymore. They are multimodal utility corridors, and that seems to be the way to get them accepted as well as funded. And so I do know that folks in my district in Houston and Willow are just begging for gas, and any way that we can get gas to them is helpful as well. So I appreciate the update on that. I know you and I talked about that earlier. So. Any other questions from anybody? But online, I don't see any. I see one person online and a couple legislators. No questions so far, so I guess you're off the hook. And what I think we'll do is take a brief at ease while we reconfigure for the railroad. So. Okay, back on the record. Our second presentation today is from the Alaska Railroad Committee. We'll be given a presentation by Alaska Railroad Corporation. As committee members are aware, Alaska Railroad has been in operation since 1903, but was established as a quasi-public corporation of Alaska in 1983. Today we are joined by President and CEO Bill O'Leary, Vice President and Chief Engineer Brian Lindemood, and External Affairs Director Megan Clemens. At this time, they're already at the table, so I'd like them to place their names on the record and go ahead and begin your presentation. If there's questions, we'll stop occasionally during the slides and ask questions if that's okay. So take it away, Mr. O'Leary.
Great. Well, thank you very much, and good afternoon, everybody. Again, for the record, my name is Bill O'Leary. I'm the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Railroad, and happy to be here and talk about the railroad. I'm going to talk a little bit about our structure, vision, and specifically sort of past, present, and future of investment in some of these larger rail extension projects, certainly PMRE, but also another important one, the Northern Rail Extension. So with me today, my far right, again, is Brian Lindemood, who is our Vice President of Engineering, our Chief Engineer of the railroad. And immediately to my right is Megan Clemens, our Director of External Affairs. And we're going to split a little bit of divide and conquer on the presentation here, maybe. Thank you. With this particular agenda. So before I begin on the PowerPoint in earnest, though, I'd kind of like to say a little something, just more of a stage setter than anything else, with regard especially to these particular projects. The railroad looks at both the Port McKenzie Rail Extension and the Northern Rail Extension as really critical economic development projects for this state, to the point that was brought up in the earlier discussion and also just a moment ago. This is a state that is, and again, no news to this group, but is, sorely lacking in just basic infrastructure, and especially in transportation infrastructure. And with the amount of stuff, for lack of a better term, I mean, from mining to other resources out there that are available but are stranded at this point, infrastructure is absolutely key on being able to bring these to market. So this is something that, you know, again, that how we approach looking at these sort of statewide economic development projects. The railroad has been very supportive and continues to be very supportive of both of these projects. And it fits very much within our mission as, you know, being an agent for economic development for the state of Alaska. And I want to be real clear that the railroad is at the table and the railroad is ready to take a leadership role in moving these projects forward again, because I think they both have lay fallow now for the greater part of 10 years or longer out there. Since some of this discussion has come back up in the last few months, you know, we have been talking with numerous stakeholders out, constituencies and different stakeholders out there, and I think it's very clear that the appetite is there to start moving these projects forward again. And again, I think there's also a very clear understanding that the railroad is not going to be able to do that on its own. So I think it really is a very opportune time for us to be having this discussion. I think it's a very opportune time to talk about what partnerships we can have between the railroad, between the different stakeholders out there, be that the borough, be that the state administration, be that the legislature, be that the congressional delegation, about how to move these really vital rail extension projects forward. So, I mean, really, we're excited about taking the lead on something like this. We're excited about working with the different stakeholders out here. And you know, these are, again, statewide economic development projects that I think are vital to us being able to move this state forward. So with that, just as sort of the prism for how, and again, at the risk of sort of wrecking the punchline on what you're going to see on the rest of this PowerPoint here, there's no questions immediately for that. Take you through the PowerPoint and we can talk more about each one of these things going forward.
Thanks, I appreciate that. And one thing before we get completely into this, I've been horribly remiss. I'm totally out of practice. I didn't recognize the governor's representative, Mr. Todd Smolden, is here, driving all the way in from Willow to attend this presentation. He's been here since the beginning, so my fault, and welcome, Todd. So go ahead, sir.
All right. Well, you'll very rarely, thanks, sir. You'll very rarely see a railroad presentation without a safety minute here. And the only thing really to take away out of this is many people think that railroad is loud and slow. And as a result, they spend time on the tracks. We urge people to, at every opportunity, not to do that. We realize we bisect this state to a large degree, and there are times when you're going to need to cross the tracks. And we ask you to do that just quickly and at a perpendicular and not walk longitudinally along there. It's, these are actual pictures that we have found on social media. And you know, yes, they look funny up there, but it really is a very serious matter for the railroad. It's a core competency for us, the safety issues, and something quite concerning. So next slide. These are our mission statement. And this is something that there's a lot of words up there, and it can really be boiled down into you know, sort of three primary takeaways, and that's safety, service, and profitability. And the railroad exists not just for the sake of the railroad existing, but to really help drive economic development within this state, be it on through our freight services, our passenger services, or our real estate services out there. We are about trying to, you know, a key piece of infrastructure, again, in a state that is you know, bereft of basic infrastructure. But again, safety, service, profitability are really the three takeaways out of that. I want to spend a little more time on this particular page just for the simple reason that it's sort of our quick facts. If you had to pick one slide and learn about the Alaska Railroad, this would be it for the most part here. As the chair mentioned, you know, we are 100 years old this year. Appreciated everybody that that did come or was able to make it to the our celebration in Nenana in July. But railroad was know, really the federal government came in, took a number of failed railroads, put them together, and recognizing the importance of infrastructure in Alaska, created the Alaska Railroad with its completion in July of 1923. And it remained under federal ownership until 1985, or early 1985, when it was sold to the state. And the legislature at the time, in its wisdom, set it up as a state corporation, but set it up as a very different state corporation. And it was different in a number of ways, but not the least of which was the recognition that it was going to operate in a competitive environment out there, providing transportation services, providing real estate services there. So it needed to operate like a business and therefore was established with many of those basic tenets in there. Set up as an independent corporation where, yes, we are wholly owned by the state of Alaska, but we are an entity separate and distinct from the state. And the primary thing about that is our debts are our own. They are not debts of the state of Alaska. There is no recourse to the state of Alaska for Alaska Railroad debts. We are mandated to be self-sustaining. And by that, I mean we have to pay our own way. Again, freight, passenger, real estate services. By virtue of the fact that we do run year-round scheduled passenger service, we are eligible for federal formula monies, just like any other state or any other passenger provider is, and we are eligible to compete for different federal competitive grants out there. We do not ask for funding from the legislature, except in really what I would characterize as extraordinary circumstances. Really, those have been large-scale economic development-type projects over the years. Very few instances of that. The Northern Rail Extension being a notable one, but we are a, but we don't again go to the general fund every year. Many of the powers of our that are vested in our board of directors, 7-member board of directors appointed by the governor, including 2 members of the governor's cabinet, 1 member of one of the 5 bargaining units that we have on the property. Of the railroad and some other specifics. But all of that said, there are a number of attachments to the state, as I said. Board of directors appointed by the governor out there. Require reports and analyses, briefings to the legislature, to the administration annually or more often, as the case may be. Certain things that require legislative approval. We want to divest ourselves in any full interest in a piece of land. Requires legislative approval. If we wish to issue public debt, it requires legislative approval. Not bank loans, but actually bonds. And we've got, you know, 600, give or take, year-round employees, swells up by another 150 or more during the summer months as we have large seasonal operation. Not state employees, but actual corporate employees with our own pay and benefits system out there. And as I said, heavily unionized is our vast majority of other railroads out there. So it really is sort of this model is sort of, from our perspective, an elegant approach to the organization. I mean, we have for us a relatively massive infrastructure. You see some of that operating data up there. You know, in a place that truthfully normally does not have the standard rail customers out there. There's very limited manufacturing in the state of Alaska out there. But so we have to take care of what we have. We have, you know, to maintain or prioritize our investment between the different aspects of our business here, to keep using the term of art, a state of good repair that we're required to, because again, safety is absolutely critical for us. And then we prioritize that between our keeping our existing assets, making them better, making ourselves more efficient all the time, and of course the economic development that we have there. So,
if you don't mind, 656 total miles of track. How much of that has been added since we took over? Since the state took over? I mean, if took over a certain amount from the federal government in 85, I think you said. And how much have we added since then? How much track have we added since then?
Mr. Chair, I'll look at Brian, but I believe there's been any material amounts added. I mean, there have been, you know, ever so often a siding or a double track put in, but nothing extensive.
Okay. Any other questions? All right.
And again, this slide is more talking just, it really reads for itself there. We do the last full-service railroad freight and passenger services out there. We run everything from Flagstop, train service. There's a number of firsts in Alaska. A very interesting barge operation, which could serve some talk about it another time. We do keep our books very similar to private industry. And as a result, we do measure net income, as private industry does. And we have a little retrospective from 2012 of our net income out there. Each year certainly has its own story out there, which we'd be delighted to talk about if there was interest. But that yellow box over on the right-hand side discusses the breakdown in the in our revenue sources out there. Again, you see with freight being the largest driver out there. We do take the monies we make after paying our operating expenses, and they become the basis for our capital budget. And the capital budget is, you know, really probably the most, really, I think in a lot of ways, the better barometer of, you know, if you wanted looking for one statistic on how is the railroad doing. And so I'm actually going to turn it over to Megan Clemens at the moment, unless there are no further questions for me, to talk a little bit about our capital plan.
So I have a question on the previous slide. I actually have a couple questions, if you don't mind. So it seems to me that freight is the biggest revenue source of your rolling revenue, if you will, or fare box revenue is 2.5 times more than passenger revenue. So I'm wondering how much Alaska Railroad has reinvested in the freight sector to help Alaska with resource development.
Representative McKay, or Chair McCabe, it's interesting. The majority of we break our capital budget into by fund source. So we have that generated from our internal funds. We have those generated from our FTA formula monies, and then we also have debt. But we use judicious amounts of debt. FTA monies, Federal Transit Administration monies, are solely for passenger-related activities. So really the majority of our internal monies go to items that are not eligible for, passenger. So oftentimes it's split between freight and real estate. Now, the benefit of having a single track is that the passenger trains run over, we fix those or we maintain that track or using those FTA monies, but the freight also benefits from that. I don't have a breakout on what exactly the split is there, but freight is a critical piece of our business, and it's very important to us to maintain the track structure and also the the rolling stock, freight cars and the like, to have enough of those and also keep them in fine running order.
Thanks. So one more, unless is there anybody else that has a question besides me? Okay. So I know there was a Supreme Court case, Laverty versus Alaska Railroad Corporation. The Supreme Court, there's a Superior Court, and the Supreme Court affirmed substantial and intimate connections to the state ultimately make Alaska Railroad Corporation lands state lands. So while not strictly prohibited by the statutes, I'm wondering about the thought process of one state-owned agency, such as the Alaska Railroad, charging another state agency for right-of-way access and then putting it in the revenue column. The point is this: if the land belongs to the state of Alaska, then this maneuver simply removes money from one appropriated budget, which the legislature is supposed to appropriate, and gives it, inserts it into the Alaska Railroad budget, all without legislative approving authority. So this seems counter to other court cases and the legislator's authority to appropriate the public money. And so I'm wondering what the thought process is. I think the DOT told me they owe north of $1 million to the railroad for right-of-way access. Does that sound about right? So I'm curious. Seems to me that we are removing money from something that the legislature appropriated and giving it to the Alaska Railroad, and I'm not so sure of the fine line there. I think it's a legitimate question that comes from somebody else, obviously not me, because I was reading it, but.
Chair McCabe, I'll take a shot at answering one part, and then I'll ask Brian to talk a little bit about the monies to the Department of Transportation up there. Again, this goes back to the model that is the railroad model, that it is to be self-sustained. And with the purchase of the assets from the federal government also came 36,000 acres of land. About half of that land is used in actual operations. So it's, you know, right away, it's yards, it's operating lands. The other half then is available for other uses, and that's where we lease it out or permit it out to either private sector companies, other governmental entities, or the like for use. And the walking around theory behind, you know, the railroad getting that land and then being able to utilize that land goes back to my earlier comment that it's a very difficult place to run your railroad just based on the lack of traffic density and the small population in the state of Alaska. So the ability to have real estate was a very consistent performer for us out there. It really provides stable cash flow, which allows us then to take those cash flows, and be able to invest them back into the railroad. So to a large degree, and for a number of years, real estate subsidized the operating portion, the freight and passenger portion. Now, as we have grown more efficient, and as different sectors of the Alaskan economy have grown, and freight and passenger have grown, and we've worked very hard at that, we, from a net income perspective, you know, certainly create operating income now, where we are making money on operations up there. But those real estate monies, again, are critical. Most other state-owned rail operations receive state subsidies. And as a result, we do not. And again, depending on who you talk to, some of the theory back in 1983-84 was that railroad, you get this land, go out, develop it, use that, and that is your dowry, for lack of a term. So with that, I'd ask Brian to comment on the Department of Transportation.
Chairman McCabe, the railroad right now does not directly charge DOT for use of the land outside of a couple areas that are more leased property outside of the right-of-way. In fact, we're working with DOT in a number of areas trying to find some counters to where we can just sort of trade. There's areas that we need to use that they have and vice versa. There is a substantial amount of money that goes back and forth between the agencies. Some of those have to do with federal requirements where the railroad or where the DOT is on top of us or doing work within a certain distance of the track or could do something with the track. We're federally required to have a railroad employee there making sure that there aren't any trains coming when the work's going on. And there's a reimbursable agreement associated with that. And that's, you know, it's really just, it costs us so much an hour, pay so much, sort of. There are other projects, Whittier Tunnel as an example, where we sort of share facilities. In some cases, depending upon the nature of it, they actually pay us to do the work versus them paying it themselves. But, you know, to that extent, it goes both ways. We have some projects going on right now where the highway is immediately adjacent to us in our right-of-way, and we're having to pay DOT for traffic control plans and doing a bunch of traffic control and so forth like that. The only other area that I'm aware that there's direct money coming to us from DOT is in the master agreement. DOT has responsibilities for a number of crossings that cross us, and through their processes and so forth, HSIP money is trying to make those crossings safer. They have crossing devices, signals, lights, bells, whistles, all of that. They do pay us on an annual basis to maintain those because it's a craft issue. Our folks maintain those on their behalf. I'm not aware of any other areas that we are directly charging them just to be on our land.
Thanks. So, yeah, one of the, I think of the number one complaint I hear about the railroad is the rights-of-way payments that people are having to pay in your right-of-way, in the state right-of-way on state land, which is actually yours, but it's owned by the state, right? So that is the biggest complaint I have. And also, and I mentioned Mr. O'Leary and I have talked before about the at-grade crossing money that the federal government has to fix exactly what you're talking about. And I'm not even sure it needs a match. They are so concerned about at-grade crossings and the accidents potential, the safety potential that could happen, whether we're talking Main Street or KGB Road in Wasilla, or talking the crossings on the parks that are really, really dangerous, in my opinion, having driven across them several times. So I appreciate that, and I'm. You'll probably see me press that grade crossing money issue again at some point. So any other questions? I guess not. On we go. Ms. Clemens.
All right. For the record, again, I'm Megan Clemens, the Director of External Affairs for the Alaska Railroad. And advancing the slide here, going to talk a little bit about our recently approved five-year capital plan and highlight some of the specific projects and programs that plan supports, as well as talk about a little bit of an overview of our recent activities in the competitive grant space. So on this slide here, you can see our five-year plan. And this really relates to, you know, the maintenance and support of our existing infrastructure. So keeping what we have in a good state of repair to support those passenger and freight operations, you know, today and into the future. So here highlighting some of those investments supported by the capital plan, you know, I wanted to pull out our bridge and track rehab programs, you know, not just because they're so fundamental to the operation of the railroad, but because they make up a not insignificant amount of that budget. You can see up there $40 million to the bridge rehab plan in 2023, $20 million to track rehab, and we've got similar investments planned for 2024 in those spaces and on into the future. You know, it's been noted a couple times, we're very excited about celebrating our centennial year in 2023. But while that's a fun milestone, it also speaks to the age of the infrastructure that we have. So, you know, we've got many bridges that are passing that 100-year-old mark and, you know, aren't necessarily up to kind of the industry standard that you see in the lower 48 in terms of, you know, load-bearing, you know, performance. And so we've got a $300 million program planned over the next 10 years to replace over 50 bridges on the Alaska Railroad and make sure that, you know, this infrastructure is going to be around and relevant, supporting Alaska for the next 100 years and beyond. For the track rehab program, you know, that as well is no small feat. You know, in my early days at the Alaska Railroad, I remember asking our head of maintenance of way, you know, kind of, what do I need to know about what it takes to keep the Alaska Railroad going? And he said, well, you know, for other railroads in the lower 48, they have extreme weather, they might have earthquakes, you know, they might have flooding events, you know, they might have these challenges. The difference is in Alaska, we have all of them. And, you know, you see that toll taken on our track and, you know, whether it's replacing the ties, whether it's ballast resurfacing, whether it's embankment fortification after flooding events, you know, it's a big project to keep our track in a state of good repair. And, you know, the funding reflects that. And, you know, again, the funding sources that we rely on for these programs, that would be those FTA formula funds that Bill already mentioned. We do go after competitive grants, particularly for the bridge program. And, you know, we support that with our own internal funds as well as debt when appropriate. A few other notable capital investments I wanted to touch on quickly. Some of our marine assets, we are rolling out the Whittier Terminal Master Plan here shortly, actually just commenced that project. So, you know, we'll be looking at, you know, revisiting the marine terminal in Upland in Whittier. The last time that we did a master plan, I think, was in 2006. So it's due for a reassessment of, you know, what the needs are there and how we can support that in the future. So we're expecting to have that complete by late 2024. The Seward Freight Terminal, again, looking at expanding that facility to be able to increase efficiency and increase capacity down on the south end there. We did successfully win almost a $20 million MARAD grant to support that effort. So we're working through the permitting and design process currently, but I believe construction is planned for the 2026-2027 timeframe on that, but that project is moving forward. And then the Seward passenger dock, you can expect to be hearing more from us about that as the session gets underway, but we are having active discussions with Royal Caribbean, you know, coming together on a final design and, you know, plan for that project. But we do anticipate looking for additional bond authorization to support that project. You know, again, still finalizing those details, but likely in the $90 million range for additional authorization to support that project.
So I have a question on the on this slide in particular. So the Seward Freight Terminal, the MARAD grant, that's the freight that they used to offload the coal from Yosemite? Was it different? Am I thinking a different? Okay. So congratulations. The passenger dock bonding, so the railroad owns the Seward passenger dock, that's correct? Okay. And you bonded this 2 years ago for $60 million, is that right? Or was it $30 million? And now, and I think that passed, and now we want $90 million, or we want to up that.
Chair McCabe, so you're correct. 2 years ago, we came down looking for, again, one of the things we need legislative authorization for is the ability to issue public debt. So at that point, the project was envisioned to be $60 million. And through a, you know, unfortunate series of events, or fortunate, depending on your perspective on this, there have been significant scope changes. I think the amount of construction inflation we've experienced over the past years has also taken its toll, and we are working towards a what I would characterize as a very different project down in Seward at this point that will require additional bond authorization. But again, we're looking to come to this with a, you know, an anchor tenant already effectively locked in, so that will provide the security for the railroad's ability to go issue those bonds.
Thanks. So you've explained this to me before, I think, but I'd like to get it on the record. So why didn't we bond for Point McKenzie when it was $125 million instead of waiting until now to push it forward at $211 million, the PMRE?
Yep, Chair McCabe. So the issue, the railroad really, you know, we use public debt, so bonds for very large projects. So, I mean, we will have the ability to go out and do bank loans and things of that nature just with our board of directors approval, and those are much, much smaller. So larger things where it makes sense to actually issue bonds are, you know, what we're talking about here. And Port McKenzie certainly fits into something like that. The issue at the time certainly was that there was no customer identified. There was no anchor tenant. There was no revenue stream that we could say, we are going to go build this project, and as a result, there will be incremental revenues that will come in, will service this significant debt. And our particular balance sheet is certainly not large enough to handle, you know, at that point, the $125 million worth of incremental debt without any incremental revenue.
Thanks.
I have one question.
Rep. McKay.
Yeah, Rep. McKay, thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Clemens, I hate to guess. Sometimes it's a game to try to guess what acronyms stand for. Can you tell me what PIP or PIDP and MARAD stand for so I'm not guessing?
Oh, gosh. I think PIDP is Port Infrastructure Development Project, and MARAD is Maritime Administration. Lifeline here.
If you're correct on both counts.
Okay.
It was, for the record, Port Infrastructure Development Project, and then what was the second one again?
Oh, it starts with maritime.
I'm sorry to put you on the spot. I didn't mean to.
Maritime Administration.
Okay. So that's
a Thank federal, you, Chair McCabe.
That's a federal?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And so if I can follow up on that, you're doing the MARAD because you own the sewer freight terminal, and that's, and Borough can do MARAD for Port McKenzie because they're on the Marine Highway, Federal Marine Highway designee list. So, okay, I got it. Thanks. Anybody else? All right, moving on.
Right. So with that, moving the discussion into competitive grants. And, you know, with apologies, it's probably basic stuff for everyone in the room, but as we talk about our competitive grants program, I thought it might be helpful to just sort of ground in how we think about our grant strategy. So, you know, the first question, how does this opportunity support our capital plan? You know, as noted, we've got a lot of needs as related to bridges, you know, track support, other facilities. So we want to be identifying opportunities that are, you know, relevant to our existing strategy. The second bullet on there, do we have the resources to support this project if funded? I mean, first of all, do we have the resources to pursue this grant? You know, pursuing grant applications is, you know, something that takes time and stewardship. But the larger question here is really, if we're successful in winning this funding, do we have the internal resources or the outside contractors to be able to deploy these funds in, you know, an efficient and effective way? Moving on down to the benefit cost analysis. So the BCA is a requirement of federal grant opportunities. And, you know, that's essentially the federal government looking to see that the benefits of a given investment are going to outweigh the funds they put into it. And the BCA is expressed as a numeric value. And, you know, the benefits can be from a wide menu of different categories. It can be, you know, increases in public safety, reducing pollution, decreased operations and maintenance expenses, you know, a wide variety of things specific to any given project. But the critical point is, you know, however you quantify the dollar value of those benefits has to exceed the cost of the federal investment. So it's got to be greater than one is that numeric value. And as a general rule, the higher the BCA, the better the chance of, you know, successfully winning that grant award. So that's something that we keep in mind, you know, as we're looking at grant opportunities. And the last one on there, how can we meet the non-federal match requirement? And that's another thing that's pretty standard for federal grants these days. And, you know, for us, when we think about our grant strategy, you know, we're meeting the non-federal match requirement with Alaska Railroad internal funds. And, you know, that's important to note, both the importance of us, you know, having profitable operations so that we can leverage that net income into bringing more federal funding into the state. But, you know, it also kind of serves as a bit of a limitation. Even if there's big pots of money out there, we've got to be able to meet the non-federal match requirement to be able to chase those dollars. And, you know, generally it's in the 20 to 40% range. So something to keep in mind, you know, if we can afford these grant opportunities. And with that said, this slide here is kind of a snapshot of our activities in the competitive grants arena over the last 5 years. So you can see we've had decent success. Since 2018, we've secured over $46 million in federal funding. And again, speaking to that non-federal match component, you know, that required us to come up with $20 million to be able to match those grants. You know, we've been lucky to have more success with grants than those that were not awarded. But, you know, you can see it's CRISI grants and, again, those MARAD PIDP grants. And, you know, in terms of acronyms, CRISI, I think, is the Consolidated Rail Infrastructure Support. It's an FRA grant that's specific to railroad projects, and we've had good success with those.
So can I a question on the BCA, right, the benefit cost analysis for grants you were talking about? So I'm interested, do all of these, like the awarded grants that we have, say the Seward Freight Dock Corridor Improvement or the Trail River Bridge Replacement, do all those have to meet the benefit cost analysis as well? Okay, so I'm curious, like, my focus is on PMRE, right? So have we considered, you know, when you're talking about the benefit cost analysis, have we considered maybe not having so many freight doubles trucks on the Glen Highway between Anchorage and Fairbanks, with Glen and the parks, by using it? Is that, would that be part of the benefit? In other words, we're relieving that sort of congestion and traffic on the Glen and the parks, at least as far as Houston, and actually as far as Fairbanks. Is that all part of the benefit analysis that you're talking about?
Absolutely. I think, you know, you could look at the emissions reduction. You could look at decreased wear and tear to the roadway, you know, benefits to quality of life of the community. I think those are all things that can be captured and quantified. But, yeah, absolutely, that would be part of the, you know, how we would look at putting together the BCA for a project like that.
Cool. Thanks. Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
Yeah.
Representative McKay.
Yeah, Representative McKay, through the chair. You know, I look at this sort of like in the private sector, you have rate of return. And for a public facility like a railroad, then you looks like you use benefit cost analysis as your primary metric to decide if something's going to be positive. So I guess I'm curious how you calculate. I guess it follows with the question that the chairman just had, is how do you calculate a benefit cost analysis? And I look at this slide, you know, one that's up there right now, $112 million from the federal government if you add those three together. Or I guess it's awarded, not awarded, and pending. Let's talk about the awarded $47 million rounding up. Does the federal government, do they just say, here's $47 million, good luck? Or do they have some kind of metric where they, you know, how much resource development is this going to open up? How much commerce is this going to provide? Is there any strings attached to that $47 million, or do they just, like I say, tell you, here's your grant, good luck, let us know how you make out? How does that work?
Through the chair, Representative McKay, the railroad internally uses return on investment just like any other business would. The federal government uses a benefit cost analysis because they're looking at greater things other than just return. Generally speaking, there are each one of these grant opportunities, they generally have certain twists to them that they would like to hit. Maybe they're looking for a more rural focus. Maybe they're looking for trying to impact economically disadvantaged areas, things like that. And it seems like every time they come out, they change that metric a little bit. But once the grant is actually awarded, really the only strings are attached or associated with Buy America, meeting grant obligations, making sure the grant, whatever you build is actually what's actually in the grant, not, you know, adding other stuff or changing it, things like
that. Representative Sumner.
Yeah, so through the chair, I hear that the railroad, in its analysis, attempts to maximize profit as part of its goal. And I just wonder, because the railroad is a monopoly, and it's an instrument of the state, but has a lot of independence. And nearly everywhere where you find a state-granted monopoly, or private sector, or what have you, there's a substantial amount of regulation. There's the profit-maximizing level of service that a monopoly would render is less than the free market level of service. So I wonder if possibly the railroad is insufficiently regulated by the adequate level of service that might benefit economic development in the state of Alaska. Maybe you guys can.
Through the chair, Representative Sumner. First of all, the railroad is not to maximize profitability. We are to remain self-sustained. And there is a difference, I think, between that. And with regard to the monopoly discussion, I can't think of one area that we are an actual monopoly. We have competition in whether it's freight, whether it's passenger, whether even for many of our real estate. I mean, we're blessed with having some, you know, very choice locations for real estate. But we operate in a very competitive environment, and we have to take that into account in all of our dealings with all of our customers.
Follow up? No? Okay. So one thing, it could be here, it could be on the next slide, I'm interested to know is, I know that the original PMRE, you were involved in some of the grants for that, and I think there are FTA's passenger, but Federal Railroad Administration, federal grants, Chrissy, for developing this, but I think the railroad needs to apply for them, not necessarily the borough. So I'm wondering, in the past 8 years and in going forward, how you are going to be involved with the borough and applying for the grants, if necessary, or have you been involved with the borough for any of the grants for PMRE?
Representative McCabe, actually, we were involved with a grant in 2021. I can't remember. It's probably on one of these next slides which grant program it was. Build Back Better is what it was. The borough, in fact, put that grant together. We did a lot of support on that as far as the technical side. As these grants continue to come out, we will continue to work with the borough where they make sense.
I can just follow on to that. I mean, I think that's why we're here today to a large degree, is to have this discussion. And as you'll see in the next couple of slides here, as I mentioned at the beginning of this, we are ready to take that leadership role in this, working with the borough and all the other constituencies and stakeholders out there in much a partnership type of format as to how we start to bring this across the finish line.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I have in one slide what the borough had in a very, very nice presentation earlier today. I don't know how much you want to go through this other than I will say that federally speaking, the Surface Transportation Board has sole discretion over, you know, rail extensions and so forth within the United States. What the railroad actually received was a license to construct and operate on the borough's behalf. And through that whole process, while the state grants and so forth did go to the borough then basically used us as like a contractor to actually deliver the amount of construction that was developed to date. I think we're all familiar with the different, you know, segments 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. On the next slide, you have two things. On the right-hand side is the state funding that came through a series of grants, and I think there's one bond authorization. The approach seemed to be basically just giving us manageable chunks to construct on an annual basis. But obviously, you know, once 2015 hit, the state found itself in a position where they could no longer support that. The project accounting on the left-hand side was really the last piece of work that was done as far as budgeting goes in 2017 by the borough. This just gives you a sense of where it all went. As far as the project status goes, segment two is pretty much at a 90% design level from a you know, ready to go to construction. We would have to go and freshen it up and make sure everything's still current. But realistically speaking, we could move on that pretty quickly. From a regulatory standpoint, all the federal permits actually have been completed. And segment two, segment, and the remaining segments don't have a federal action associated with them, meaning there's no wetlands, there's no nothing. It's really all uplands. the only regulatory things that have to happen is the Surface Transportation Board and their EIS gave to us no less than about 100 different mitigation measures that needed to be followed through. Now, some of those were fairly simple, basically said that we had to send them a report every quarter updating them on how we're meeting those mitigation measures. But other than that, most of the mitigation is finished, and the regulatory part is finished.
Go ahead if you're going to stay on this slide.
I have
a question before you get...
The roadbed preparation and sub-ballast placement, that part of it, we built the embankment. All that is finished. Before we put track down, there's a layer of basically roller compacted rock that goes down. Because that grade has been sitting out there for a number of years now, we're going to have to go in and scarify it, recompact it, get the grass off of it, take the ruts out of it before we put that back down. Likewise, the estimate that is attached to this, the bimodal facility and the port itself, when we constructed that, we basically just made, you know, I can't remember how many acres out there, maybe Mike remembers, but it's like 40, 50, 100 some odd acres. The whole thing's flat. There's no prism or track beyond, and so that's included in that. The telecom, signal construction, and then the railroad facility construction really are just in a conceptual state right now. And when I say a railroad facility, the intent for this was basically for mineral-type extraction. It was originally operationally designed around coal coming from Usability and being exported. And because trains would be coming from the north, you stop, you unload, you inspect before it goes out. We would need some sort of facility for two things, crews to get out of the weather, report the work, things like that. And likewise, if there's a car that needs to be repaired or switched out or something like that, again, getting it in out of the weather so our folks can repair. And then finally, the track construction. The track construction piece of this is about 60% done. As a practical matter, it's probably one of the last pieces that would need to get done, but we moved that track along as both the railroad and the borough were chasing opportunities along the railroad with customers and so forth. We've had annually, I think, we probably have 2, 4, 6 different opportunities to come along, and we work with those customers, and Port McKenzie is oftentimes part of that discussion. Things that, well, there's the Build Back Better grant, and likewise, as we've discussed, we're continuing to discuss opportunities at Port McKenzie. Most recently and actually ongoing, we've been discussing possibilities with ADA as it relates to Ambler development and so forth like that. So I'm going to pause there, I believe.
Sure. So a couple. One of the things that we didn't talk about with Port McKenzie and we haven't talked about yet is the Department of Defense. And I'm also interested in hearing you say potential customers, and I'm interested in knowing who you have discussed Port McKenzie with or PMRE with as far as potential customers. So Mr. O'Leary said that we would need a customer, and I am out there actively, my staff is out there actively sending letters to potential customers saying, if you could be interested in this, we need interest. Because the federal government wants interest, right? They want to see potential customers. I get that. Mm-hmm. So who has the railroad talked to, and have you talked to the DOD? Because I know that they have visited Port McKenzie dozens of times in the last 6 months. So various components of the DOD.
Yeah, Chairman Cabe. So, you know, oddly enough, kind of going, harkening back a little bit to when this was, when the monies were still going on this thing back in the 2013-2014 time frame, it was interesting that there was, you know, definitely more interest back then, and there was more activity over, being done, and, you know, other customers, prospective customers, potential customers were definitely talking to us more then. I think, you know, I have not been involved with many customer discussions at this particular point with regard to Port McKenzie. Most of them have been, as earlier referenced, in the energy sector and the concept of especially related to LNG. So a number of different groups, many of whom I think probably under non-disclosure agreements with that. But again, I think broadly, energy sector is where I'm aware of things. with regard to the military, we have had a just had a very recent discussion with the military, but it was related more to the Northern Rail extension, not specifically to Port McKenzie. But I think that's something that we'll find our way back to JPRA for.
Thanks. And one question with a probably a quick answer. What's the lead time for steel for getting rail? Is it a year, 2 years? I mean,
through the chair, rail's relatively available. Railroads are buying it all the time. It's not quite something you're going to go pick up at Home Depot, but it's something that they're rolling consistent.
Thanks.
Can I get one?
Oh, sorry. Rep. McKay has a question.
Sorry to dig in here, Mr. Chairman. This is Representative McKay. So real quickly, just so I can kind of put it in perspective, slide 14, we've already invested $184 million. If we brought that forward to today's dollars, and you may not have done that yet, or I wonder what that would be in today's dollars, because I want to compare that to the 231 that we're looking at on slide 17. Like, I'm trying to kind of, are we half done? Are we two thirds done?
Okay.
That's the spirit of my question. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
That's my first question.
Through the chair, Representative McKay, generally speaking, the work that we've done with estimators and so forth, the cost from 2012 to 2020, the increase was about 30%. The increase from 2020 to 2023 was another 30%. And moving forward, the cost estimators that we use are recommending that we use a 3.5% per annual increase as we move forward. So all in, about 70% between 2012 and 2023.
Okay. And I think, if I may, Mr. Chairman, through the chair, you know, we're all legislators sitting here assuming that this project gets support and moves forward. We're all going to have to answer to our constituents about, you know, I can hear it now. You know, well, we're building a railway to nowhere. You know, that familiar phrase. No, that's not what we're doing. But we're trying to build infrastructure to promote resource development, and it's probably impossible to measure. But we have to at least tell our constituents, have to give them some idea of the benefit of mines that would be developed, gas that would be transported, and so on and so forth. Maybe we can't describe a rate of return, but at least we can tell people there's going to be jobs, there's going to be tax revenue. How are we going to get our money back? I guess, you know, if I was going to be just real hardcore, I'd say, how am I going to get my $231 million back? And I don't expect you to answer that today, but I think that's, if we move forward, Mr. Leary, and your wonderful team here today, how do we answer those kinds of questions that are going to be asked in the public realm? I hope I'm making some sense. Thank you.
All right, any other questions?
They didn't answer.
Yes.
So I just wanted to clarify one more time. Is it the railroad's position that you do not have a monopoly because other modes of transportation exist? Because I think, you know, I don't know, but I doubt Bell Lab or Bell Telephone advanced the argument that you can communicate with passenger pigeon when their long distance monopoly was broken up, but subsequent to that, you know, we've had massive innovation. The rates for long distance telephone essentially, I think, dropped to zero. I've seen a long distance charge in a long time, and you know, there's been massive benefits to that. So, does the railroad have the position that you do not have a monopoly because trucks can run on the road or barges or?
Through the chair, Representative Sumner, you know, whether the, you know, strict definition of we meet, whether we have a monopoly or not, I can tell you that we have competition in every line of business. And we actually have to take that very much into account when we do price items out there, because it's something, again, if the question relates to, you know, are we, you know, effectively gouging? I mean, and I'm, again, I don't mean to be putting words in your mouth, but if that's what the direction the question is leading, first of all, there are certainly ways Brian can actually talk about with regard to, you know, there's recourse to, you know, Service Transportation Board about, you know, shippers, aggrieved shippers that don't feel comfortable about that. But, you know, the vast majority of the of our customer engagement is through contracts that are being entered into, you know, presumably at arm's length transaction on this. So it's something that, you know, I feel very comfortable in the pricing, in our approach to pricing about this, given the model that we are working under at this point. And I don't know if that answers your question or not, but try and hear.
Just real quick through the chair, what recourse would, say, like a local municipal government have in a crossing contract? I suppose they could abandon the crossing? Because I've read those contracts, and they're about the most unilateral thing I've ever seen. So what recourse would they have?
Well, through the chair, Representative Sumner, so I'm clear, you're not talking a transportation contract, you're talking a crossing permit?
Yeah, you have an at-grade crossing. The railroad decides that maybe crossing signal upgrades are necessary or what have you, and the railroad, I believe, does the design, says what the price will be, and that they shall pay, right? Or else no crossing?
The way the crossing contracts generally work is that, you know, the crossing is there, you know, for the convenience of whoever's using the crossing. That crossing is maintained by the railroad. It's a craft issue. And we bill basically, you know, costs incurred, costs bill. Over time, that crossing is going to wear out. One of the things we do with our crossing permit holders is work with them and try to give them advance notice to the extent that we can, saying, hey, this is coming due, you need to plan for this and so forth. And we do things to try to encourage them to get the crossing built in such a way that, you know, it's most cost effective. You know, we can put temper planks down, but they're only going to last 5-10 years before they're completely trashed, versus, you know, spend a little bit more money up front for concrete. Likewise, when it comes to the crossing safety, whether it's a passive crossing, meaning just, you know, a stop sign and crossbucks versus lights and gates and so forth like that, state policy actually asks us to put together a diagnostic team, which includes, amongst others, the DOT. And the DOT generally is the expert when it comes to vehicular safety and crossings and so forth. We put together a report, and basically the recommendations of that report say, you know, what level of crossing safety needs to be there. You know, it doesn't cost much to have a stop sign and crossbuck sitting there, but having something, an active warning device that needs to be inspected every month, needs electricity, where, you know, there's parts that wear and so forth, those are a lot more expensive. And likewise, just like, you know, things get obsolete, after a period of time, we can't get parts for them anymore, and they need to be upgraded. Sometimes that's federally mandated, and sometimes it's just a function of something's 20 years old, and we just can't make it work anymore, and whoever built it isn't making those parts any longer. Depending upon the situation, we do work with crossing owners, trying to, you know, limp things along and work with them budget-wise. But that's really how that works.
I think the defining question is it the railroad crossing road that's owned by somebody else, or is it the road crossing the railroad? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair McCabe. Through the chair, this is, I think, another stab at Rep. McKay's question. Are there, and this is either for the railroad or perhaps for the Port McKenzie presenters, have there been any recent studies on the economic viability of Port McKenzie with the railroad?
Through the chair, Representative, to the best of my knowledge, no. Nothing updated from the railroad's perspective anyway.
So there are four ports in the United States, saltwater ports, that do not have rail. Hawaii's one of them. Miami with their cruise ships is another one. Galveston, they have a certain amount of availability of rail, but they have to truck to it. And the Port of Long Beach, which is hugely congested, doesn't have rail to their saltwater port, right to their saltwater. Every other port, saltwater port, in the United States that's a viable port has a rail component to it. So one of the things I think we're sort of dancing around here is the if you build it, they will come sort of thing. And I think we are demonstrating today with our natural gas issues, with our issues with our Indo-Pacific allies needing, whether it be coal, natural gas, critical minerals, we're demonstrating that if we had built this when we should have built it 8 years ago, we would be in a position right now, they would be coming in droves because Alaska has what everybody needs that China or whatever is putting a moratorium on, and yet we have no way to get it to them because we didn't complete what we started to do because we got scared or whatever. We got scared of the coal crisis, the pricing crisis, whatever. We didn't have, so we didn't take the risk, which is one of the most sort of un-American things I can think of, is just sitting back and saying, whoa, wait a minute. But whatever the reason, we didn't do it. So that's sort of the issue, and that's bloviating, not really a question. So if that makes any sense. Sorry. Yes, sir.
Representative McCabe, and to Representative McKay's question earlier, I thought it was a rhetorical statement. I didn't realize you were actually looking for an answer to that. If the question is the railroad going to work with, the Matsuburo and others out there to determine what the business is, we're going to absolutely have to do that. We're going to need to do that. We're going to do that because, again, as Megan was talking about, to make that benefit-cost analysis, pencil out to be able to have, a good shot at this grant, that's going to be required, going to be critical.
Okay, good.
So maybe I can follow that benefit-cost analysis thread just a little bit more, and we've got plenty of time. We're scheduled for another hour in this room, so if we go over, I hope you'll indulge me. It seems kind of subjective to me. So how does an economist determine what the benefit is of taking a number of large trucks off the Glen Highway to Fairbanks and putting them on the railroad at McKenzie or putting them on the railroad to the Port of Anchorage? How is that determined? It seems to me that there is a number of sort of fluid things in here that could be manipulated to maybe make the benefit-cost analysis make sense, or maybe say, no, we can't do it. So I'm curious who does that and how it's done.
Chairman McCabe, the grant, the competitive grants that we have, at least within the last few years that I've been involved with, that benefit-cost analysis is actually dictated by the granting agencies. They have a whole government document that basically says, thou shalt do it this way. Obviously, I think, it's up to the applicant to sit there and come up and try to come up with all the different benefits that something would provide. And if they forget one or miss one or something like that, it's not in the analysis. They're not going to come back and say, hey, you forgot one. So to that extent, we generally use a contractor that's familiar with that, and we work with them very closely trying to, market board up all the different benefits that we can think of, and then there's a standard process they go through to then assign a benefit to it, weigh the cost against.
Okay, thanks. Anybody else? Is there a problem?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just went back to page 7, so we're looking at the revenue sources. So freight is 44% of your revenue. How much of that is military money?
Through the chair, Representative Kronk, I don't have that answer directly. I think we do. The military is a good customer of ours, especially It perhaps has dropped a little bit in the last year or so as the strikers have moved out of Fort Wainwright. We would be a subcontractor to one of the steamships that would oftentimes get the bid for transporting the strikers from Fort Wainwright to somewhere, get them down to Port of Alaska, Port of Anchorage, get them on a ship, and get them to wherever they were going out there. That was something that would happen depending on the year, depending on their training budgets, you know, 3 to 5 times a year, perhaps, out there. Been a little less, certainly late the strike was gone, but I believe, looking to Brian to see if we're still, to the best of my knowledge, doing some military moves, perhaps not of the same magnitude that we're doing out there. I mean, it's all revenue is good revenue on our freight side. I mean, it's not something that's, I can't sit there and tell you it's 20% or anything like that, though. I don't believe it's anything of that nature.
Okay. Where were we?
We're on the slide that everyone loves to hate. We, after the meeting in the borough, here, I think 2 months ago now, went out and hired a third-party contractor to basically take a hard look at the work that's been done to date and give their opinion as far as what the estimate to finish the project is. Sort of in broad-based categories, when this meeting was scheduled, they were originally scheduled to be due at the end of the month. We ramped their schedule up to at least get us near final numbers by today. We will have a full report from them around the month. But what they're telling us is the segment two civil construction, they believe if they were hard bidding it today, mind you, these are in 2023 dollars, about $42 million. The grade preparation sub-ballast for the entire project to include the bimodal facility is at 24.5. The fiber optics telecommunications, they believe, is around 6. Track construction, which is the very large number, is near 98. The terminal facility, environmental mitigation that remains, and the engineering and legal, those were not very far along as far as giving them that third-party contractor to do the estimates on. We elected to, in those particular cases, actually ramp up the 2017 numbers that were left over from the borough because we felt they were more accurate. And the cost from 2017 to now, if you go do the math, is about 3%. And then finally, there's the administrative cost of just running the project from a project management and grant management standpoint. And all we did there was we just took what it was for the first $184 million and then put it back in. For a grand total, if you were to, be out there building this today in 6 below weather, for $211 million. Next slide. So from that 211, one of the things that isn't in any of those numbers is any sort of contingency. Typically, we're proposing a 10% contingency in this. That's pretty light for a project of this size, just given, but the flip side is we believe the engineering and everything is far enough along that we don't expect to see any major hiccups. But even the 10% contingency on $190 million worth of work is not insignificant. Getting us to 231. The problem that remains is that's if we're building it today and bidding it today. And the reality is that the path forward on this, even with state appropriation, it's unlikely that we would start construction for 2025. Federal would be a year past that. And at 3.5% per year inflation, those numbers go up. Depending on whether you're state, whether you're federal, you're basically at $250 million plus or minus one way or the other.
Just a real quick question, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Thank you for that. Just really quick, I think in the previous slide you said it would take 3 years to construct, so could we take that $248 million divided by 3 and say that you would need $83 million per year. We wouldn't have to come up with the $248 all at once. Is that kind of how this could work, or?
Through the chair, Representative McKay, that's exactly how it could work. That's how it worked before.
Okay.
We would have to work with the borough. There's some things I know they're still working on. It. I think Mr. Brown said they're going back and talking to about some of the land they have to go re-up, if you will. But we could certainly put together some sort of plan if that would be helpful.
Well, that's how I run my personal finances, so, you know. thanks for the answer.
Okay. Any other questions? On we go.
Northern Rail Extension. The other one. Northern Rail Extension, for those who are unfamiliar with that project, was originally envisioned to provide surface access not only to the significant military training ranges on the south side of the Tanana River, as well as to the missile defense systems out of Fort Greeley. At the time, the only mechanism they had for surface access to those training areas was via ice roads in the winter, and those were somewhat unpredictable, and obviously they were somewhat restricted seasonally. That gives you a sense of the training areas that it would touch and so forth. The next slide is the time series history of that project going all the way back to the 40s. Some of that has to do with, you know, the eventual extension of the railroad to the lower 48 through Canada. As a practical matter, the military started getting interested in this project in the early 2000s through a series of earmarks from Senator Stevens. The Alaska Railroad started on an EIS. That EIS had no less than 8 cooperating federal agencies, including 2 from the military. We moved through the EIS, continuing on through. Got a record of decision from the Surface Transportation Board roughly in 2008, and continued moving forward. The size of the project was significant enough that once it sort of like Fort McKenzie, but sort of on a much grander scale, we started to break the project into phases. The first phase was always going to be the bridge over the Tanana River. The primary reason is to do any work on the other side, we needed access. And so that first phase was a Tanana River bridge. Go to the next slide. In Salsha, we built a 3,300-foot-long bridge, longest bridge in Alaska, along with a significant amount of river training structures upstream of it that actually helped to alleviate a lot of the seasonal flooding that Salsha was experiencing every year as the Tanana River continued to try to migrate towards the highway. That bridge was funded with $104 million of DOD, again, earmarks from Senator Stevens, as well as 2 separate state appropriations totaling $80 million. And that bridge was completed in 2014. And the military is using it occasionally as they're moving over there. They are in the process of a significant amount of work over there building roads and things like that, and their use is becoming more and more frequent. And we're continuing to work with them as far as coordinating that with them. The next slide sort of gives you a sense of the phases. Phase 2 is building the 13 miles from North Pole to Salsha and across the bridge. What that would do is that would provide railroad access to at least 10 and a flats. Phase 3 is the next 30 miles that would actually connect the Donnelly training ranges with 10 and a flats. And then the last 38 miles would connect the railroad the rest of the way to Delta Junction. This project is in a little bit different place than where Fort McKenzie is. Where Fort McKenzie really does not require any additional federal evaluation outside of potentially related to a federal grant funding the completion. Of those 8 agencies, only 2, the Surface Transportation Board and the Federal Railroad Administration, ever actually published a record of decision. Those other agencies, the BLM, the Air Force, ALCOM, Coast Guard, Corps of Engineers, and DNR are likely going to require a significant amount of reevaluation of that document, because at this point it's about 15 years old. And it's unclear as to how long that's going to take and what level of scrutiny that they're going to require. So that's part of it. Adding to the complication is there's at least four different federal landowners that, you know, when given a unless otherwise directed, they're going to be, look at this as permissive versus directed as far as potentially getting that right away, and that tends to slow things down and can complicate things. When we did the routing analysis, I think the route that we have selected and the route that we are pushing for only has about 20, give or take, private landowners across the entire 80-mile length. That was intentional to try to keep that number as low as possible. And likewise, the significant landowner other than the feds on the south side of the town of Rivers, DNR, and there'll be a substantial amount of work I'm trying to figure out the most appropriate location and things that they're going to need for that construction. Once we get through all those hurdles, we believe construction is going to take about 5 years beginning to end. The budgetary estimate, again, and this is nowhere near as in-depth as what we did on Port McKenzie, moving a 2012 estimate forward. Phase two, which would include final permitting for hopefully the entire project, right-of-way acquisition, 13 miles of construction, right about $205 million. Phase three, around $651, and phase four at $826. There is a little bit more contingency in these numbers because I'm dealing with, in some cases, a little more than lines on a piece of paper versus actual plans that have earthwork quantities, bridge lengths, and things like that.
All right.
Back to you.
Back to me. All right. So funding strategies. So, you know, we've been asked to bring some ideas of how we might pursue some competitive federal grants to support both of these projects. And, you know, it's worth noting, you know, Mr. Brown had mentioned this during the borough's presentation earlier, but, you know, there hasn't been federal money contributed to Port McKenzie to date. And, you know, federalizing the project could potentially bring some risks, you know, as it relates to perhaps reviewing the EIS and, you know, the time delays that might incur. But certainly I think we can all appreciate that, you know, federal funds bring some great benefits, you know, as related to advancing projects as well. So, you know, these were the three funding sources that working with our consultants we identified could be a good fit for really either of these projects, starting to look here at Port McKenzie. The first up here is, you know, the CRISI grants. You might remember from earlier in the presentation, we do have a good track record with this granting agency. And, you know, the window to apply for this one is coming up quickly. So we're expecting that, you know, either next month or in early January. And that's, I believe, a 90-day open window closing in April is what we're planning for. And that one does have a minimum 20% non-federal match that, you know, is a hurdle that we need to consider in pursuing that grant opportunity. But, you know, CRISI is there to invest in rail improvements and enhanced multimodal infrastructure, and, you know, it could be a good fit for this project. Next down on the list is the mega grant. That's actually one of three grant opportunities under that multimodal project discretionary grant umbrella. And, you know, mega is there to support, as they say, you know, large projects that are difficult to fund by other means. And, it, you know, they do, I think last year there were 9 mega grants awarded for an average of $133 million. So, you know, it's on kind of the scale of what we might be looking at to move one of these projects forward. The other kind of interesting thing about the MPDG grants is, you know, infra and rural are under that same umbrella to other granting opportunities. And USDOT has actually streamlined the application process so that you can submit one application for all three projects, and DOT can, you know, take a look and review, you know, see which pool of funds they think might be relevant to the project. But that helps streamline the application opportunity, so that's an interesting one there. And then finally, the RAISE grant is also a DOT opportunity. And, you know, that's there to build and repair infrastructure to help strengthen supply chains, which, again, I think there's a strong case to be made for Port McKenzie, you know, aligning with that purpose. You know, there's a standard 20% non-federal match, and I was remiss, and I mean, it's on the slide, that's, you know, true for MEGA as well. But I should mention, you know, RAISE, we've learned there is the opportunity to appeal to DOT for 100% federal funding with no non-federal match, which, you know, of course is of interest. But it's not commonly granted, and there's no precedent for waiving the non-federal match for, you know, projects of this size and scale. But, you know, it's something of interest, something for, you know, looking into, because that obviously would be ideal.
Mm-hmm. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair McCabe. Through the chair, is there an estimate then for the award, if given, for all of these grants put together and how that relates to the current project costs for the remainder of the project?
Well, you know, I think it would depend on how we wanted to, you know, approach the project. If it was going to be a multi-year thing where we'd be looking for, you know, individual years of funding, you know, if we thought there was a chance for, you know, a lump sum award to support the project, that might be, you know, a little ambitious to try to go out and seek. But I think, you know, this is all part of the discussion of, you know, what's available, what do we think we can support with the BCA, you know, what kind of non-federal match can come up with, because again, the larger the grant amount awarded, the larger the match that, you know, we'd need to be ready to deliver to support that grant.
Okay.
All right, and then continuing on to the next slide, looking at some strategies for the Northern Rail Extension. And again, those three different federal grant opportunities that I just outlined, we think could be relevant for the Northern Rail Extension as well, so I won't, you know, recap those again. But Northern Rail Extension, you know, it sounds like this might be something to take a look at for Port McKenzie as well. But, you know, with the history of military involvement with the Northern Rail Extension, Department of Defense community infrastructure grants are, you know, something that could be relevant for the Northern Rail Extension, provide access to those training grounds, or, you know, at Fort Greeley. You know, that is contingent, of course, you know, on the military, you know, agreeing with thinking that this is a priority and something that, you know, they think is going to fit into their future plans. And as Bill mentioned, you know, we're restarting those discussions, you know, with the military in Alaska to try to understand what their vision is, you know, and how rail can potentially be a part of that. And then on here also, congressionally directed spending. So, you know, we've had recent conversations with Alaska's congressional delegation, and certainly there's interest from both Senator Sullivan and Senator Murkowski's project in the Northern Rail Extension, Port McKenzie as well. But, you know, I think the Northern Rail Extension, for the national implications for national security and the military training aspect of things, and then, of course, the, you know, potential for commercial development and, you know, getting trucks off the road. And, you know, bringing resources where they need to be by rail and sparing the highway. So, you know, earmarks are something that, you know, could potentially be part of the mix. It's worth noting here that, you know, the very large sums of money that we saw, you know, in the early days of funding the Northern Rail Extension, it's a different environment these days, and we don't anticipate getting, you know, $100 million earmarks to support this project, but you know there may be a place for that in the mix of funding and rail extension.
Thanks. So I think you're maybe going to touch on this in your next slide, but you know, I read yesterday I think about a toll road in Florida that was put together with a public-private partnership, and all the government part was is they bought the rights away, and the private folks did the whole rest of the thing, and it was significant, the amounts of money it took to put this big long toll road in. So I suspect maybe that's where you're going with the need for partnership slide, which is on the next slide. although I didn't see any of the PPP sort of.
Chair McCabe, to be very clear, we're open to anything. All right. I think this is going to be, it has a possibility of being challenging, but I think that, again, it's a worthwhile, these are worthwhile projects. These are important economic development projects. So, you know, we've got the need for partnership slide up here, and I think it's going to be critical for both items that we put up there, the benefit cost analysis and the match portion of this. Do have partners, as I mentioned, and been, I think, very consistent on. These things are of such of a scope that the railroad's balance sheet is just, you know, really a non-player in something like this. So whether it's through, you know, federal grant, and again, to Megan's point, I think the environment is very different from the idea of Senator Stevens basically generating the kind of earmark monies that done back in that time for the NRE. So, you know, the conversation that we are looking to have and are having right now is going to be one with the true Representative McKay's point, you know, of talking to anybody and everybody about this, because we need to understand what the commercial opportunities are for these particular projects. We need to understand, because that's going to be critical for trying to put together this PCA. We're going to need help to the extent we can from the congressional delegation in looking at these grant opportunities, trying to determine which of the grant opportunities, are the ones to go after at this particular point, and at what level. Because, again, you know, is it a non-starter to go in for a $260 million project? Possibly. And so is it better to, parse this thing down? The match is, a real question, and it's something that I think at the legislative level is something that's going to there hopefully be a conversation about this that especially taking, and again, each PMRE and NRE are similar but different on these. I mean, there is lots of federal money sitting over in NRE already. There is none in PMR. So using the term that the borough used, federalize PMRE, well, what are the implications of that? And how is that going to work? But if the idea is not that the state is not going to be able to fund PMRE in total here, then, talking about the match opportunities coming from the state with the federal grants taking on the majority of it is one particular approach, but again, it needs to be run to ground with the all the other stakeholders in this too. But it is going to take not a village, but a partnership here to get folks together on this and make sure we're all rowing in the same direction and being able to put this forward.
Two sets of donuts, you and Ben. So thanks for that. And what I'm this kind of goes back to the benefit cost analysis again. So I just spent a week with a bunch of Canadians that are very interested, government folks in A2A, not private investors that are going to flake on us again, but government MLAs and ministers and premiers that are interested in Alberta to Alaska, Yukon. As you can see from the map that I brought back, it's a little bit dated, but I wonder in the benefit cost analysis if we have included things like, if we completed the Northern Rail extension, is there a benefit in transporting military folks all the way down via rail instead of driving them down here and craning all their stuff onto a ship and doing it via saltwater into a 48 training area? So just a sort of a random thought, but I wonder if we've considered that. Canadians pretty much said they're going to rail to Tope, close to Tope. And they looked at me and said, what are you guys going to do? So, I'm thinking that there is some opportunities there that we could capitalize on if we can kind of commit together to sort of marching forward. So Anyways, sorry, bloviating again. You can continue.
Well, your bloviating is only stopping mine from finishing off here. So it's no, really. I mean, I think that is the you know, that slide's total on that. I mean, the next part is just really going to finish off by saying what I began with at the beginning here. You know, the railroad is very supportive of these projects, very supportive of the idea of infrastructure in this state. And again, that second bullet up there, you know, we've got to balance that with our taking care of what we have at this particular point. But the way to move this thing forward is through the partnerships. And again, these are, I think, you know, so much of Alaska's economy is trapped or stranded because of a lack of infrastructure to be able to get the products to market. I think stepping up and trying to figure out the solution to that is going to be critical for all of us. It may not be an immediate, you know, a quick answer here, but I think it's something that that has to be worked on. I think we have to start that first step.
Thanks. I think Representative Cronk has a question.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I don't know if I have a question or I'm just going to go off on a rant here. I'm going to apologize if I get too crazy here. Obviously, 3 years ago, when I first became a legislator, this was a hot topic. And when we were talking about this, pretty much the railroad had no interest in this because of the cost. Obviously, we have a new interest in this because there's a Manh Choh mine that's going in Tetlin, and we have a lot of pushback from everybody. So my problem is we had the 100-year celebration. It was awesome. But how have we expanded in 100 years? And this is not, it's just, I apologize. I know I'm directing it to you, but we have no vision for this state. Our cheap energy and transportation are what's holding us back. We could have developed the eastern interior already. These mines could have been already going if we had this rail to Delta alone. I'm just going to go through some stuff here. Industry, we have mining, timber, gravel. This is just getting into Delta. Military, obviously, we already know what the military can do. Food security. I get thinking our last food security task force, the rail extension at Delta was one of their number one priorities because Delta is just waiting to explode, whether it's producing 5,000 head of cattle, pigs, growing food, all that stuff. Obviously, there's tourism, and then transportation is, you know, cheaper goods, cheaper fuel, everything relates. But one of my big things with this mine here is we have these small communities, and per se, this is a little, Tetlin is a little tiny village, very poor, probably one of the poorest places there. Something like this gives Tetlin an opportunity to actually be self-determining. You know, these kids are now watching their parents go to work. They've never watched their parents go to work. This is more, it's bigger than just money. It's about how are we setting up our future for Alaska. And I guess that's my frustration with this, and I don't feel like I'm just dumping it on you because I guess I am, but we have to have a bigger vision. Yes, it's going to cost money. Do we subsidize the ferry system? Absolutely you do, but it's for the betterment of Southeast Alaska. It's for the betterment of those little communities. We know we can't pay for those things. We can't tax people enough to pay for those things. So projects like, you know, the Port Mac, that totally benefits the Wasilla area, the whole area there, but it also benefits the rest of the state because we are creating opportunities for people that we don't have at this, and we're not going to have. If we don't do things like this, we're not going to have opportunity. The government can't sustain the state with jobs. We have to have opportunity. And I watched this little tiny project right here. These are my friends that I grew up with. These guys are working. They're making $100,000 a year. They're taking their kids, you know, on vacations. This is our vision, and I hope that you guys can have that vision also, because the rail has to be a part of our vision. So, sorry, I went off on a rant there. Obviously, these phases we have, we built the bridge to nowhere. That's like, you know, most people call it out there. It just seems, and then we have people, you know, I probably shouldn't say this, but now we have people jumping on the bandwagon that have been actually in these positions for the last 15 years, or some of them prior for the last 40 years, when this stuff should have been done, but now let's get it done. And it leads to so much frustration now, especially for this one tiny little project, because we're going to put trucks on the road, haul ore, and it's caused a total uproar. And I understand both sides of the situation, but at some point Alaska has to move forward and say, hey, we need to do this for the betterment of our people. So they are being self-determined. I believe Delta Junction would absolutely thrive with this railroad to get to Delta. We're going to see things in Alaska that we've never seen before, but without that railroad, we're not going to get there. So thank you for listening.
Anyone else want to rant?
Those folks who sit the dam.
So I do have one kind of follow-up question, and it's something that's bugged me for a while since I kind of started into this railroad thing, but AS 4240-260 says the Alaska Railroad Board must include an analysis of potential sale arrangements whereby the corporation may be transferred into private ownership on your annual reports. And I've looked as far back as I can see on the Alaska Railroad website, and I can't find anywhere that has been done. So maybe less of a question and more of a statement. I will kind of be looking for that. It's actually in statute, so I don't know how we enforce it, but it's there. So it's a concern. So if you don't mind.
Chair McCabe, absolutely. There used to be a line on the very back page of the annual report that just basically lined out whether there had been any, for lack of a better term, legitimate discussions that had occurred in a year as to whether or not there'd somebody looking to purchase the railroad. I believe that in the time that I have been with the railroad in this position over the last 10 years, there have not been any of those. But we can make sure that we address that, make sure that language is explicitly addressed.
Yeah, I suppose the modifier potential means you can put it in one line, but really it says it's an analysis. So, it used to say you had to go out and get 3 RFPs for people that were going to buy the railroad, and the legislature sort of relieved you of a little bit of that responsibility. So, recently there's been nothing, so I'd be interested in that. If you don't mind, one more little thing. Kind of like Rep. Kronk says, I've been hearing about this forever. And Alaskans are screaming for help and transportation on their roads, and the Moncho Mine is a classic example. If we had finished our project, this wouldn't be an issue. The Richardson Highway and trucking, or 240 miles to Kinross, we'd be making money. The railroad would be making money off of doing that. Instead, we're going to give it to a trucking company, and we're going to make a bunch of Alaskans really angry because we're running trucks on the road. So, if you consider the world changing, the LNG tanker, icebreaker tanker coming from Russia across the top, with the warming Arctic, that's going to be a player. And we're not in a position to capitalize on it because we haven't finished our projects, whether it be PMRE or the Northern Rail Extension or A2A. We just kind of backed off from it. And we're uniquely positioned to reap incredible benefits. Somebody's got to take the bull by the horn. Somebody's got to say, yes, I'm the railroad guy. The railroad in Alaska belongs to me. Lean on me, and we'll march forward together. And unfortunately, Mr. O'Leary, that would be you. So I think we fail our constituents. We fail Alaskans if we don't. We're thinking about 5 years, 6 years. Am I going to make money in 6 years? We need to be thinking about, and you said it in your last slide, 100 years down the road, what is we going to leave as a legacy, you and I, for our children and our children's children? So, and again, what really frustrates me is we could have done this PMRE anyways for $125 million if we had just continued. And now it's going to more than double. We're going to add another $125 million to the project because we got worried. We got afraid, I think. And to me, that's just not the way Alaskans do things. So thanks for the rant, everybody. Anybody else have any rants?
No? Well, for Mr. Chairman, this is Rep. McKay. Through the chair, I just want to thank the two groups that presented today. It was really informative. Thank you. Really curious. The four training areas, let's see, Tanana, Yukon, Donley, and Gersley, I think it's pronounced. Is that all state land? Does anybody know? Or is it a combination of?
Through the chair, Representative McKay, it's all federal.
Oh, darn. I was hoping we could charge him enough rent to pay for all this. That's all federal. Okay. I'm glad I asked. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you coming, and I appreciate the presentation. I know it's time out of your day, but I think it was it's valuable for Alaskans. We do have public testimony in, I think, I have one person for public testimony, so you can hang around if you'd like. I'm going to open the meeting right now for public testimony if you want to listen, and then go from there. So we'll open this meeting of the Transportation Committee for public testimony, and I have one person online, and it's Robert Hall, president of the Houston Chamber of Commerce. And go ahead and put yourself on record, Mr. Hall, and provide your testimony.
Hello, my name is Robert Hall from Houston, Alaska. I'm the president of the Houston Chamber of Commerce, and actually, we support this very strongly. We'd like to express our appreciation to this committee for renewing its interest and for previous legislators' support of the Port Mac Spur. Worldwide, a key to economic development is the ability to move our goods and natural resources to market economically through mass transport via waterways, pipelines, and railroads. As was just stated, the railroad and the Point Mac Spur should be a key part of Alaska's development for the next 50 to 100 years. Now, after COVID, in a volatile political environment, it's important for Alaska to renew and make a statement of support to industry, the railroad, and the local governments, that development of the spur is part of our future. It's not just export. As been previously stated, if the railroad was already, spur was already in, there would be transport of natural gas to Fairbanks economically and at a much greater savings than trucking via the railroad. That German company, Siemens, was up here trying to get support, and it's a leading LNG company. They would not have only transported or built a large LNG plant and transported gas to Fairbanks, but they would also put it on rail cars and by barge shipped it to coastal villages throughout Alaska. Don Young's last major accomplishment was approval of the Alaska-Canada Railroad. We still need Canadian approval, which is held up by Trudeau's environmental opposition, mostly because of the potential export of oil produced from tar sands. That's the political situation through treaty or whatever, and through some potential that we know technology that could be resolved. It's the political situation. There's no one large industry knocking on the door right now to build this railroad for us, but there certainly is more than enough uses of the railroad to justify its potential down the road if you combine them all together. We thank you. We hope you make a statement. What you're doing now is very important, and if you can renew the state's commitment, then we can start to gather these resources. Remember, we didn't get it's a big thing going on. We didn't get the pipeline overnight. We had to wait for the embargo. We could have, as Don Young said, you could have one change of elected official in Canada. You could have a change in policy towards natural gas. There's a lot of things that are volatile, and we need to remain committed. And we thank the legislature for your interest and support of our future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Okay, that's it for on the phone public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that would like to give testimony? Okay, seeing none, I'll close public testimony. And anything else from the committee? Well, I certainly want to express my thanks to the railroad and to the Matsu Borough for coming and giving a presentation in this blustery November day. But it beats traveling to Juneau, I guess, and especially to my committee members. I appreciate you coming and showing up, and those online as well. So with that, we're adjourned at 3:40.